Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bank of America goes for the sympathy vote on the broadcast today. The post office just needs some sympathy. And finally, how to make it in America. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the very last day of September 2011. Good as always to have you with us. One can almost pity Bank of America this Friday afternoon, almost being the operative phrase there. Not only did the website for the biggest bank in the country crash for a couple hours today, but B of A is getting beat up real bad over that $5 a month debit card fee thing that it announced yesterday. That's not, by the way, $5 a month to use the ATM either. That's $5 a month if you use your B of A debit card to make a purchase, even for a lousy cup of coffee and a donut. Like I said, you can almost feel sorry for B of A. So we sent Marketplace's Sarah Gardner off this morning to find out why they did it.
Consumer advocate Ed Mierzwinski says banks are always raising fees, but this one?
No one was expecting them to come out with a $5 a month fee to use your own money.
Bank of America's debit card fee doesn't start until next year, but it's already angered consumers who haven't forgotten they helped bail out the bank as taxpayers. But analysts say bank revenues are under pressure, so expect B of A's rivals to impose the same kind of fees. New federal restrictions on overdraft and card charges will cost the industry billions. American Banking Association General Counsel Ken Clayton.
And so when the government came in and basically capped the amount of revenue they could get, banks had to figure out if they want to keep offering consumers products, how do they do that?
Banks aren't just feeling pressure from the feds. It's the anemic economy, too. Consultant Bert Ely.
Deposit interest rates really can't go much lower, and yet the amount of interest that banks are earning on their loans and securities has been declining, so they're getting squeezed.
B of A's nearly 39 million debit card holders do have options. Switch to a smaller bank or credit union, or just start putting all their purchases on a credit card. Aha, says analyst Bart Narder, B of A might just love you migrating your everyday purchases to your credit card.
And of course, they'll hope that you migrated it to a Bank of America credit card.
Where, Narder says, the bank stands to make more money on fees and interest in the long run. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The end of September brings us mercifully to the end of the quarter, 3 months that Wall Street and much of the rest of the economy actually would gladly leave behind. We, however, can't do that quite yet. It's Friday, which means it's time for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. And for that, we've got Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News. She's down in Washington, D.C. Cardiff Garcia, also from the blog FD Alphaville, is in our studios in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So since you're up at the top of the show, we have to do a little bit of news here. The statistic this morning was consumer spending is up a tad. Cardiff, wages were flat. Is that news or is it just noise?
It's noise. It's one report. That being said, I mean, it's also part of a longer, longer trend, which is that given where the economy is right now, yeah, incomes have stagnated. And that's, by the way, for the people who are lucky enough to have jobs. So, yeah, OK, that report is noise, but and it can be revised later, but it's part of a longer trend, and it shows just how much we need strong economic growth. Unfortunately, that's probably not going to happen anytime soon either.
Well, so we've got like a year through the election, Lizzie. When's it going to get fixed?
Oh, I don't think you're going to see a big fix anytime soon, particularly because some of the prophets of recession are saying, I'm really sorry to tell you this, we're there again.
Oh,
we're
yeah.
there already.
See, now, wait. First of all, A, that makes me sad, and B, you're skipping like to the fourth question that I had on my list. But go ahead.
Well, look, this is a firm that looks at this stuff and says, we're there. And one of the things that Cardiff is talking about is that wage stagnation. You see it in all of those monthly mm-hmm. job reports. We're not seeing the kind of growth that in some cases even keeps up with some of the core inflation that we look at, even though inflation's not a big deal.
I would offer, actually, just on this topic of recession, I would offer that probably 75% of the country would say we never got out of recession, and that only Wall Street and the top like 3% of income earners in this country ever saw the light of day. So Cardiff, how do you explain to them that it's really not a double dip, it's a whole fresh thing?
Look, they've got a point, and for a big chunk of the country, it certainly feels like we never left the recession. Hey, you know, what do they care about the actual statistics? I mean, if you don't have a job, it doesn't really matter what GDP is doing, right? So there's no easy way to explain it, and I frankly share Lizzie's pessimism. I think to get stronger growth, what you need right now is a forceful policy response or an economic miracle. And frankly, I think the chances of either of those happening is about the same. So,
all right. Well, since this is
sorry to be a buzzkill on Friday afternoon, but
yeah, that's all right. Since this is a business show, we'll go with a forceful policy response instead of the miracle thing. And Lizzie, let me ask you: I've honestly lost track of where the president's jobs bill is. What's the latest?
The latest is that there is a strategic discussion about how to move that package. One of the things that's going on is a question of whether you want that to be one big bill, a lot of little ones. So that's important because it gives you a sense of how they want to try and get this through Congress. One thing that I actually thought was pretty interesting, we had a poll out today and global investors said they actually thought certainly the infrastructure part of this, more than half of them said that could lower unemployment. So investors like it, but politicians are different from investors.
Yeah. Back to this recession thing for a minute. The firm that you were talking about before that has come out with this research showing we're already in a recession is a European firm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hello, Europe. Can we please be done with that? When is that going to end, the debt cycle and all that stuff? Cardiff, help me out.
Look, the latest out of Europe is that this bailout facility that was agreed to in July will probably end up being ratified by the needed governments. But unfortunately, it's not that big. And there was a great line, I think, in the Washington Post today that said that this is like giving the firemen the hose they need to put out the fire and not enough water, right? So it's probably enough to contain Greece, but it's definitely not big enough to contain the fallout, you know, to the rest of Europe. And because what you have there is a political problem, one of political fractiousness all throughout the continent. So I think there's no end in sight right now unless something really dramatic and unexpected happens in the next month or so.
Lizzie, very, very quickly, is Washington paying attention to Europe in a substantive way?
I think the financial policy folks are. Certainly Secretary Geithner is. But, you know, Congress has got a whole other argument to deal with on this jobs front. And frankly, they just managed to avert a shutdown. So, you know, they're not super focused on Europe.
Lizzie O'Leary, Bloomberg News in Washington. Cardiff Garcia with the blog FT Alphaville in New York. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Traders pretty much slammed the door on Q3 about as fast as they could today. The sad music when we get there. You go to the store, you buy a candy bar, Three Musketeers, let's say, whatever, and that's your chocolate. Oh, that it were so simple. This week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced it's discovered hundreds of new kinds of cocoa trees, the stuff from which chocolate is made, down in Peru. And that could mean new chocolates, each with its own flavor, and an even newer, even more special specialty chocolate market. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
We're not talking Hershey's milk chocolate bars here, which is not to put them down. I'm a fan. But single-origin chocolates are something entirely different in price and flavor.
It has these deep, rich notes of like blackberry and plum and smoke and chocolate. And it just has these amazing layers of flavor that just go on and on and on.
Art Pollard is the chocolate maker for Amano Artisan Chocolate. He's describing his $10 chocolate bar, sourced from the remote Venezuelan village of Chuao. Hearing him talk about his single-origin chocolates is like listening to a wine fan go on about their favorite bottles.
Is chocolate getting snobby?
No, I don't think so. Fundamentally, with chocolate, anybody can appreciate it.
True enough. But some connoisseurs want to know exactly where their chocolate is coming from, and the rarer, the better. Marcia Mogolansky is an analyst at Mintel.
Now people are getting more educated on types of chocolate, and they're developing a more refined chocolate palate, just as we did with coffee a little while ago.
With the USDA discovery of the additional types of Peruvian cocoa, there's more talk about establishing geographical designations for the sweets. It's a move that could pay off for cocoa farmers and chocolate producers and mean higher-priced gourmet chocolate bars.
It's worked for wine. It's worked for coffee. There's no reason it can't work for chocolate.
But don't expect your vending machine candy bar standby to start touting its origins anytime soon. The high end may be on its way up, but there'll always be a market for plain old chocolate. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
There was a rare bit of undiplomatic language at the State Department today. A spokeswoman said that they, the State Department that is, had, quote, read the Riot Act to the Syrian ambassador in response to attacks on a motorcade carrying the U.S. ambassador to Damascus the other day. It's just the latest development in the long-running protests happening in Syria. Anthony Shadid covers that country for The New York Times. We reached him in Beirut, Lebanon. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
This is, if you check the calendar, the longest running of the Arab Spring protests. And I'm wondering, best as you can tell, because foreign reporters can't really get into Syria, what it's doing to day-to-day life there.
Well, Kyle, I think that depends on where you're at. If you're in Damascus or Aleppo, there still is a notion of normalcy, however we define normalcy. But life does go on there. And I think a lot of people are struck when they visit those two cities how much life is unchanged in some ways. Now, on the other hand, if you go to a city like Homs, and that's Syria's third largest city, it's a war zone in some respects. Not all neighborhoods, I don't want to say, but some neighborhoods do have the semblance of a very protracted armed struggle going on there that may last for quite a while.
Well, about that timing and the length that these protests have already lasted, is there concern that you can tell of the violence destabilizing the rest of the region, Turkey or Jordan or Iraq to the other side?
Well, I think there's a deep sense of anxiety across the region over the implications of Syria's descent into chaos or civil war, what a civil war might mean. And there's no question that if a civil war did erupt in Syria, every neighbor of Syria in the Middle East would have a role.
As far as you're concerned, I gather by your choice of words, this is not yet a civil war?
Well, I think you see in a place like Homs the makings of a civil war. I think there you do see an armed opposition. You see the deepening of sectarian animosities in a very dangerous way. You see assassinations and killings that would remind you of what we saw in Iraq, especially in 2005. But we can't say that, you know, Homs is a metaphor for the rest of the country. But I think in some ways it does provide a window on what Syria's uprising could turn into in the months ahead.
The violence of this week, specifically the attacks on the American ambassador there, Ambassador Ford, the other day, have brought out strong words from Secretary of State Clinton and the president. And you get the sense that Washington is grasping for solutions as to what to do. Is this, in your mind, something that embargoes can solve, can force President Assad from power?
Well, I think there's a sense out there that the Syrian government is going to eventually fall. I think that's the sense among American and, say, Turkish officials, and Turkish officials have played a very key role in this. The question is when. And the estimate I was given by someone very senior in the Turkish government was 6 months to 2 years. And their idea was that sanctions and economic hardships would definitely play a role. Now, I think, you know, they could be accused of having, you know, of some wishful thinking going on. This is a government whose inner circle has not cracked yet by any means. I mean, is it inevitable that it falls? It's impossible to say, but I think that is the thinking out there. And the thinking is that, you know, as the uprising goes on, as economic trouble within the country builds, and it is building, there's no question about that, as sanctions have more and more of an effect, eventually you're going to see a crack somewhere within that inner circle.
Anthony Shadid, covering Syria and the uprisings there for The New York Times out of Beirut, Lebanon. Anthony, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Coming up, how to make it in America?
You know, you have to beg, steal, borrow, and just to scrape by and to make every step.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here we go. The Dow Industrials peeled off 240 points today, 2.1%, closed at 10,913. The NASDAQ off 65 points, 2.6%, finished at 2415. The S&P 500 sliced off 28 points, that's about 2.5%, ended at 1131. Results for the week were mixed. The Dow added 1.3%. The NASDAQ lost 2.7%. The S&P 500 down 0.4%. For the month, the Dow gave up 6%. The NASDAQ off 6.4%. The S&P 500 down 7.2%. And just because it is today, the 30th of September, results for the quarter, the worst since the depths of the financial meltdown in 2008. The Dow ended down 12.1%. NASDAQ unloaded 12.9%. S&P down 14.3%. Yeah, sorry about that. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with two free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues construction spending data for August. Automakers are slated to report sales for September. And Nobel season begins. The award for physiology or medicine is the first to be announced next week. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This being the last day of September, it's also the last day of the fiscal year for the federal government and government-like entities, which brings us to this. The U.S. Postal Service is about to report as much as $10 billion in losses. Things are so dire that the post office is about to start running television ads reminding us that snail mail can't be hacked and important documents won't just disappear with a random errant mouse click. Even the best ads in the world, though, won't stop the billions of dollars in cuts that are coming, including a cut that businesses don't like one bit. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now on the costs and benefits of Saturday delivery.
Stop delivering mail on Saturdays and you cut labor costs for postal workers. But it would also delay a lot of mail from heavy users, charities sending out solicitations, marketers sending out ads and discount offers. Gene Del Polito is with the Association for Postal Commerce. He says some marketers want their ads to land on a Saturday. They want you to go out shopping.
Bye. Eliminating Saturday, you may be missing getting the person at a time when they might be more receptive to seeing what's inside of their mailbox.
But it could be a good thing if you want to avoid getting mail that could just ruin your weekend.
And if you happen to be a bank, you have to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations to figure out what is it going to mean to you to lose the time value of that money because the payment may be coming in later, the bill may have been received later.
No more Saturday delivery is something Jim O'Brien definitely doesn't look forward to.
We publish four of the nation's leading magazines, Time, Sports Illustrated, People, and Entertainment Weekly.
O'Brien's at Time, Inc., which drops a billion magazines in the mail every year, plus bills and renewal notices. But mailing Sports Illustrated magazine so it arrives on Friday instead of Saturday is a big headache.
That would put extreme pressure on us to either change our editorial closing schedules or possibly add additional printing plants.
Still, cutting Saturday delivery may look good compared to the alternative, says George Mason University professor Lee Fritchler. He recently surveyed small businesses that send ads and bills through the mail.
And about 75% of them said that they would prefer losing a day of delivery to raising rates.
Problem is, the post office's budget hole is so big, businesses might have to settle for both. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We dodged yet another government shutdown this past week, as Lizzie O'Leary mentioned. It's the third time this year that Congress has been able to agree that government ought to at least be open anyway, so that's good. As will not surprise you at all, though, most Americans aren't all that happy about what's going on in Washington. Gallup released a poll this week that showed 82% of people disapprove of the job Congress is doing, which brings up two questions. What about the other 18%, and whose fault is it? Here's commentator Rob Walker.
Who is to blame politically for the mess that is the United States economy and the apparent failure to arrive at anything resembling a policy for fixing it? Some say Democrats, some say Republicans, but more and more people prefer to say Washington. I assume that a sweeping distaste for politicians is older than Washington himself, the actual guy, I mean, but it's become particularly fashionable since the debt ceiling standoff to be discussed not just with the president, Congress, or any political party, but with Washington in general, you know, the whole system, man. People pass off anti-Washingtonism as a kind of wise and brave insight. Politicians are all the same, just a bunch of bums. But this attitude is absurd, particularly since the debt ceiling debacle. I can't remember a time when the disagreement about what to do next has been more clearly defined. One side argues for a mix of budget cuts and new spending. The other side insists it's all about slashing wasteful government, period. Whichever way you come down on that argument, it's a very simple one. Responding to it by condemning the argument itself is not just redundant, it's counterproductive. Politicians are manifestly not all the same, as evidenced by their diametrically opposed policy ideas. Each side seems to have a core group of supporters, but then there's a third camp, the vaunted independent, whose point of view boils down to existential despair about the inability of others to forge solutions. It's actually this third camp that allows, in fact forces, the policy paralysis that it pretends to abhor. The two bickering parties have no particular reason to budge as long as they figure they have a shot at winning over public opinion in general. After all, equal opportunity discussed with Washington hurts each antagonist equally. Unless somebody wants us to become a protectorate of Canada or something, then Washington, the whole system man, has no rival. So enough with being against Washington. That's not getting us anywhere. What are you for?
Rob Walker is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Design Observer. You can send us your comments. Marketplace.org is the website. All you have to do is click on that link that says Contact. This has always been the place, right? America, I mean, where anybody can start with nothing and turn it into something. People are quite rightly questioning whether that's true at the moment, but the hope still lingers. Ian Edelman has it. He developed a television show around it, too. How to Make It in America starts its second season on HBO this Sunday. It's a classic ensemble piece about a couple of fashion designers and other budding entrepreneurs trying to find success down on the mean streets of Manhattan. Ian Edelman joined us in our New York studio with Victor Rasuk, who plays one of the aspiring designers on the show, Cameron Cam Calderon. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Ian, give me the pitch that you gave to HBO when you said, listen, I have this idea for a fashion show in New York, and it's really not about that at all.
Were you there? I was like, I have a pitch for a fashion show that's actually about sort of, you know, aspiration in downtown New York City. And it was just sort of, it's that who will I become mid-late 20s existential journey.
The thing that came through to me as I was watching a couple of episodes was that it is about the hustle.
Hey, yeah, 100%. In Ben and Cam, you have two characters who set out to make it in the world of fashion who are outsiders. And I think, you know, you have to beg, steal, borrow, and to scrape by and to make every step. And so there is kind of a real-time learning curve, especially in season one. In season two, they have a lot more sort of understanding. But, you know, they're beginning at the beginning, from finding a spool of denim to wanting to launch a denim line.
Victor, tell me about your character a little bit, Cam Calderon, but also, you know, the way this thing pulls together, the threads of the stories that come through in one episode, there's a lot going on.
Well, there's always a lot going on in New York, and that's to give credit to Ian, who just sort of captured all the ups and downs and all the things that happen in New York. But in terms of my character, you know, he's sort of like, you know, he's that guy that doesn't take no for an answer. You know, I mean, he's trying to venture in a business he doesn't really know nothing about, but knows that there's a lot of money to be made. Yeah. And what's so great about the show is that he hooks up with a friend of his who, Cam, you know, he's Dominican, and, you know, this kid is his best friend, played by Brian Greenberg, is Jewish. So it's like, all right, I'll get the money, but you become the brains of the operation. Right. And I think that's just like the tall tale of like all the New York stories, you know.
The name of the show, obviously, is not How to Make It in New York. It's How to Make It in America. Right?
Why they say if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
Come on,
yeah,
Kai.
I know that. Come on. Yeah, I grew up in Westchester. Dude.
You heard that one?
That's right. Victor, I want to talk about two other guys who are native New Yorkers, made it big in fashion, and who I imagine sort of influenced this show. And Ian, you can weigh in here, obviously, as well. Ralph Lifshitz, now known as Ralph Lauren, and Calvin Klein. Right? Two guys from the Bronx who made it big.
Yeah, and Ian, you should tell him about the story, how it was inspiring.
Can I just jump in? You know, obviously for me, the Ralph Lifshitz story was like a big thing in my family growing up. My parents are first generation Eastern European Jewish immigrants, and so they would tell us about Ralph Lifshitz, and the story is like bonkers, you know. And it's the spirit of that is the spirit of Ben and Cam. They're cut from that cloth.
Well, so let's play that out a little bit. There's a scene in one of the episodes coming up, Victor, in the second season, where you go and you've been called to a meeting with this big fashion designer whose name I forget. And you're all excited and you go in and you sit down and she says, boys, great opportunity for you. And you get more excited. And then she says, I want you to design the T-shirt for my kid's middle school graduation. And you right, remember that? Okay. So and you are clearly PO'd. And yet Ben says, wait a minute, you know what? We can do this. There is a tension between the got to make money and you got to do what it takes to get by thing, right? And that's sort of that scene right there.
Yeah, it is. And again, a testament to Ian's writing. You know, he really captured the whole, what is Cam about and also what is Ben about, you know, mm-hmm. and also tells about their backgrounds and how they grew up. And for Cam, he's like, all right, cool, you know, so how much and when is it going to pay?
That, right.
And
then Ben is like, you know, it was great. Yeah.
No, yeah. And then Ben, you know, Ben, he sees the it's a longer road, you know.
Yeah. So carrying on with the theme of the title of this show, How to Make It in America, I got to ask each of you this question. Ian, you now are running a show on HBO, which is doing well, I imagine, beyond your wildest dreams. So have you made it?
I have not made it, but I have this amazing opportunity and I hope to continue to keep doing it.
Victor Rasuk, what about
you? He stole my answer. That was the same answer I was going to give.
Victor Rasuk and Ian Edelman from the show on HBO called How to Make It in America, Season 2, coming up. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you,
thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a word or two about the protests in Lower Manhattan that have become known as Occupy Wall Street. Maybe a couple of hundred people have been camping out for 2 weeks, not so far from the New York Stock Exchange. Until today, all we really knew is that they didn't like the way things are going in this country. But there is now an official declaration of the occupation of New York City on their website. It's pretty long, but here's the key part. We come to you at a time, it says, when corporations, which place profit over people, self-interest over justice, and oppression over equality, run our governments. There follows a list of 20 specific complaints and an asterisk at the bottom that says, and I quote here, these grievances are not all-inclusive. There's a link to it on our website if you want to check it out. All right, that's it. It's a Friday. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow peeled off 240 points, 2.1%, ended a lousy quarter. The NASDAQ off 65 points, 2.6%. The S&P 500 down 28 points, 2.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, you think you're too smart to fall for a con man?
I interviewed a guy who was a retired chemistry professor. He lost $900,000 to a movie investment scam.
Ouch. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that this weekend, and we will be back on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.